here derives from the Greek Orthodox liturgy, which refers to the moment in a sacrifice of the Mass when the bread and the wine are transformed by the Holy Ghost into the body and blood of Christ. At this moment of consecration, the everyday realities of bread and wine are charged with spiritual significance. Given Joyce's employment of this term to describe his intentions in Dubliners, it is not surprising that commentators have made much of a similar use of a theological term in Joyce's Stephen Hero, which he was at work on concurrently with Dubliners. There he used the idea of Epiphany, literally a manifestation, but theologically the feast commemorating the manifestation of Christ's divinity to the Magi, to write of an artist's duty as he saw it. By an epiphany he meant a sudden spiritual transformation, whether in the vulgarity of speech or of gesture or in a memorable phrase of the mind itself. He believed that it was for the man of letters to record these epiphanies with extreme care, seeing that they are the most delicate and evanescent of moments. First we recognize that the object is one integral thing. Then we recognize that it is an organized composite structure, a thing in fact. Finally, when the relation of the parts is exquisite, when the parts are adjusted to the special point, we recognize that it is that thing which it is. Its soul, its whatness, leaps to us from the vestment of its appearance. The soul of the commonest object, the structure of which is so adjusted, seems to us radiant. The object achieves its epiphany. But critics have not always been so ready to take Joyce at his word here, often failing to accept C.H. Peake's assessment that there could hardly be a more emphatic assertion that an epiphany was an apprehension of the thing's or person's unique particularity, and not a symbol of something else. So when Dubliners gives us details of rooms, pubs, streets, churches, cityscapes, when it scrupulously attends to the to and fro of conversation, the momentary gestures of an individual, it is not because these things can be read as items in a complex process of reference to abstractions, concepts, historical and mythological analogues, systems of thought, or even transcendent truths. Rather, it is because it is in the givenness of the real, in time and place, that psychological, social, cultural, and moral realities will reveal themselves. Not, of course, that the details of life in a city as burdened with history and experience as Dublin will not carry with them associations, hints of parallel situations in the Irish and European past, in legend and mythology, and carry with them too general implications for the society observed in this exacting miniaturism of focus, to give added force to the moral urgency of the writing, or to augment the sense of significance revealed. But it is in the details of the work and the complex patterns which they achieve in individual stories and in the book as a whole that meaning is in fact primarily vested. To seek to experience it as any other kind of thing is accordingly to cheat oneself of the subtle particularity of a text whose meanings are inseparable from the most delicate and evanescent of moments, recorded with shocking precision. So the detail of Joyce's art in Dubliners is not simply the realist's involvement with a congeries of fact as a reflection in prose of a world which palpably exists before and after the act of literary composition, though realism is not the least of the artistic effects achieved in this multi-level text, but the strategy of a symbolist who believed that the given in the hands of an artist would speak its own radiant if disturbingly uncomfortable truths about the world. It was, Joyce believed, the artist's duty to expedite that uttering forth, that manifestation through his placing of such epiphanic moments in a context that allowed the reader to discern their possible significance. As Stephen has it in Stephen Hero, the artist who could disentangle the subtle soul of the image from its mesh of defining circumstances most exactly and re-embody it in artistic circumstances chosen as the most exact for it in its new office, he was the supreme artist. In Dubliners, Joyce chooses to re-embody the details of a Dublin life he knew intimately in a context where they would interrelate with one another to compose an interpretive statement about the city as a whole. Thus, it is not only that the details of the Joycean Epicletae in Dubliners enjoy the added significance that historic echo, cultural association, or mythological analogue can variously provide as they seek to reveal their truths, but that they occupy a text in which patternings of incident, imagery, and structure intensify the possibilities of a controlling artistic vision. Dubliners is therefore much more than a series of sketches set in a particular place, linked by an authorial preoccupation with manifestations of personal and social paralysis. It is, as numbers of critics have shown, a work which achieves a complex pattern of repetitions, parallels, and restatements of theme in which detail, incident, and image combine to establish a vision of life in the capital, which serves as a kind of metaphor for the spiritual condition of the Irish nation as a whole. At an apparently simple level, as Brewster Gieslin suggested in a pioneering, if somewhat too ingenious, essay, the idea of escape eastwards is a constant in these tales, that happy consummation denied by a paralysis of body, affect and will, in which Father Flynn's affliction seems only the paradigmatic case. Evelyn frozen in immobility at the end of Evelyn, Mr. Duffy in silence and solitude halted under a tree at the end of A Painful Case, the snow-capped statues in The Dead, stony equivalent of Gabriel Conroy's atrophied emotional life, all seem more than instances of particular fate, but emblematic of a pervasive malaise. There are, too, the prevailing colours of the work, the ubiquitous brown bricks of the buildings, the shadows of enclosed rooms, the darkness that seems to fall in so many of the tales that are set at day's end or at night, which means what little light does get through in these tenebrous tales is candid and cruelly revelatory, like the lamplight on the gold coin at the end of Two Gallants. And that coin, so shockingly highlighted in that story, reminds us of how frequently coins are the material expression, in the book of economic and personal relations perverted and thwarted by dishonesty, disappointment, evasion, frustration, so that the pitiful coinages of these exchanges are the counters of a corrosive spiritual desuetude. Eating and drinking seem to play their parts too in a symbolical economy where they may or may not parody, as some critics have suggested they do, the celebratory feasts of the Christian Church, its communions and Eucharists, but certainly lack the creative conviviality that the meal as symbolic action represents in more ample societies than that of Dubliners. Only in After the Race is a meal exquisite, and the word there seems only to highlight the decadence and folly of that story's climax. Elsewhere, a little sherry is taken, a plate of peas and a ginger ale hungrily consumed. Mr. Duffy dines alone, drink is always to hand to sedate or inflame, so that the Dickensian largesse of the hospitable Christmas board in The Dead serves to rebuke both the parsimony and the grossness of many of the appetitive occasions in the earlier stories. The broken bread collected, the sugar and butter safe under lock and key after breakfast in The Boarding House, Lenehan's solitary unique and recherché biscuit and the real cheese in Two Gallants, Farrington's gulp of plain porter and a caraway seed in Counterparts, Gallagher's crass reduction of marital relations to a crude gustatory metaphor. Must get a bit stale, I should think, he said, in A Little Cloud. So detail in Dubliners is disposed like brushstrokes in a complex canvas to compose a settled impression of a society in the grip of paralytic forces. Those broader masses of colour which we may designate incident in the text also contribute to the picture, establishing its broader outlines and internal structural rhythms. The book, one observes, is framed by two stories that might exchange their titles without effecting notable damage. Sisters invokes the dead Father Flynn. The Dead deals with a sisterly duo. Between these, stories like A Little Cloud and Counterparts establish patterns of similitude and contrast. In these two stories, both the weak and the strong man finish at home in states of equivalent powerlessness expressed in contrasting reactions. Parallels are drawn across the pages between such texts as Evelyn and A Painful Case, in both of which a failure of nerve leaves a character in a state of terminally destructive self-denial. The frustrated boy in Araby has a partner in the childlike figure of Maria in Clay as they both discover disappointment at Journey's end. In Two Gallants, a young woman is exploited by a predatory male. In The Boarding House, a young man is a victim of female cunning. And there is, too, a sense of concentrated accumulation, the basic perceptions of the Joycean vision finding more and more confirmatory perspectives as the book moves deliberately through the stages of childhood, adolescence, maturity, and public life. The publication of so complex and strategic a work as Dubliners in 1914, with its ostensible realism and complicated symbolist deployment of detail and structural pattern, whatever it may have done to aid the course of civilization in the author's own country, most certainly marked a chapter in the history of modern prose fiction. For in Dubliners, Joyce seized on certain late 19th century developments in English prose fiction and made of them the instrument of an art that was both experimental and markedly enabling for his own development as a writer. And in so doing, he demonstrated the literary significance of the short story as an artistic form of remarkable economy and charged implication. When George Russell suggested to the young Joyce in 1904 that he might contribute some stories to the Irish homestead and thereby make a little money, he was only pointing out an obvious feature of the literary marketplace as it then existed in the British Isles. An increasingly literate but often ill-educated populace in Britain and Ireland was avid for magazines and newspapers of all kinds. Commercially minded publishers were happy to satisfy this new appetite. Their productions often contained short tales, sketches, impressions of places and persons, the sort of thing which might while away an hour or two in the evening after work or enliven a train journey from suburb to city. At popular level, the stories of such as Conan Doyle in the Strand magazine with his famous detective Sherlock Holmes achieved enormous success. Other magazines indulged a reading public that sought sensationalist stimulation, adventure yarns and stories of imperial exploit and derring do. At their best, as in the stories of Kipling, these achieved their own special artistic integrity. The heyday of the great Victorian reviews, the Cornhill, Fraser's Magazine, with their solemn essays and serialized novels in many episodes, seemed to have passed, and the field for serious fiction was largely abandoned to shorter, more populist forms of writing in proliferating outlets that lacked the cultural authority of their more prestigious predecessors. However, a few journalists sought to stand against the tide, not by seeking to sustain archaic modes of cultural production, but by a deliberate experimentalism. The psychological sketch in The Yellow Book, with its prose excursions into the worlds of urban alienation and private perspectivism, had set a fashion which bore fruit in the 1890s in collections of short prose pieces with titles like Keynotes and Monochromes. The issue as to the short story's artistic legitimacy became a matter for discussion in the more literary of the periodicals. In 1898, for example, in the Fortnightly Review, Henry James opined that the short story has of late become an object of almost extravagant dissertation, and added his own voice to a debate about the fictional effects of brevity. Are there not, he wrote, two quite distinct effects to be produced by this rigour of brevity? The two that best make up for the many left unachieved as requiring a larger canvas. The one with which we are most familiar is that of the detached incident, single and sharp, as clear as a pistol shot. The other, of rarer performance, is that of the impression, comparatively generalized, simplified, foreshortened, reduced to a particular perspective, of a complexity or a continuity. Even as a schoolboy, Joyce seems to have been aware of the advanced taste of the 90s. His brother Stanislaus tells us that in his last year at Belvedere, Joyce began to write a series of sketches which he called, most fashionably, silhouettes, and the vignette which Stanislaus described as one of these is something one might have expected to have come upon in The Yellow Book or The Savoy Magazine. But it also, as Stanislaus recognized, anticipated the first three stories of Dubliners, and described a row of mean little houses along which the narrator passes after nightfall. Contemporary commentators on the short story were not only exercised by such issues of technique as James addressed in the Fortnightly Review. Questions of subject matter were also raised. Common life was deemed an appropriate theme. Indeed, Henry James could reckon the end of the 19th century as the advent of a time for looking more closely into the old notion that to have a quality of his own, a writer must needs draw his sap from the soil of origin. But it was James's fellow American, the short story writer and novelist Bret Harte, from whose novel Gabriel Conroy Joyce took a name and an imagery of General Snow for the dead, who stated this doctrine most explicitly with reference to collections of short prose sketches and tales. Considering the rise of the short story in his native America, he wrote in 1899, "It would seem evident, therefore, that the secret of the American short story was the treatment of characteristic American life, with the absolute knowledge of its peculiarities and sympathy with its methods, with no fastidious ignoring of its habitual expression, or the inchoate poetry that may be found even hidden in its slang, with no moral determination except that which may be the legitimate outcome of the story itself, with no more elimination than may be necessary for the artistic conception, and never from the fear of the fetish of conventionalism." It was Joyce's genius in Dubliners to combine these strands of thought about the short form in a work which exploited the technical experimentalism of the psychological sketch and prose impression while sustaining an unshakable aesthetic commitment to life as it was really lived in a provincial place as the proper subject matter of the developing art form. The result was a work both uncompromisingly objective in its moral envisioning and tantalizingly inscrutable in its subtle significations. For Dubliners, as well as being a chapter in the moral history of the author's race, the entirely persuasive portrait of a city is also a study of the obliquities, evasions, and uncertainties of human consciousness in its strange occupancy of a world at once so apparently answerable to language, but at the same time so indifferent to its suasions. Joyce, the prose technician, in defending Dubliners to Grant Richards, spoke of a style of scrupulous meanness as the appropriate expressive tool for his diminished subject matter in Dubliners. This, in several of the stories, reveals itself as a mode of free indirect style which, purporting in the third person to offer the objective account, in fact enters the consciousness of a protagonist and makes the character's habitual formulations the stuff of narrative. Maria's euphemistic evasions in Clay are only the most obvious example of such a process in a text which is much less stable in tone and register than Joyce's own description would suggest. The fact that the source of the book partly rises in the psychological sketch, with its employment of free indirect style to individualize a fictional portrait, gives a troubling indeterminacy to many of the work's key passages. It is as if such passages are half in the world of dramatized thought and feeling, and half in the world of those many facts which give the book its sense of a real world made manifest in oppressive, burdening detail. There is present both the given Dublin of the turn of the century, with the social and cultural signs and symbols it embodies, which justifies in its complex reality the act of annotation that this edition attempts, and the insubstantial incoherencies of memory, desire, hope, defeat, which constitute the ambiguities and unknowabilities of the affective zone. Dubliners is accordingly an enigmatic text for all the realism of its apprehension of its world and for all its moral certitudes, its epiphanic realizations. It offers fragments of human experience that may or may not amount to defining moments. Where a sense of definition or closure is attained, it is often of a kind so problematic as to constitute a new deferment of readerly gratification. In some stories, to Gallant's Grace, we are cunningly brought to a conclusive revelation that ironizes the preceding matter, instructing us in the superficiality of our prior attention. In others, A Painful Case, Evelyn, we are allowed to realize the limits of a consciousness that has been made available to us but are left with a sense only of the futility and oppressiveness of the knowledge we have gained. And in some other stories, the first three tales of childhood in particular, when it is the protagonist himself or herself who seems to apprehend a truth about the events that have occurred in the text, it is in terms so opaque as to be undecidable to the reader. How, for example, do the concluding sentences in An Encounter and Araby relate to the events and psychological matter they apparently climax? Why does the narrator feel that they do? What advancement of learning does the narrator in The Sisters undergo as he records a disturbing fragment of conversation? Wide awake and laughing like to himself. So then, of course, when they saw that, that made them think that there was something gone wrong with him. What exactly had Polly been waiting for at the end of A Boarding House? Is it simply the closing of the trap in which she had played the part of willing bait, or does the arch, slightly mysterious tone in which we are encouraged to read her mental state suggest we should check our reading for hidden motives? It is not only in its epiphanic endings or in those moments which epiphany seems at hand that Dubliners functions as an oddly unstable text, ostensibly all naturalistic detail and yet knowingly at work in the recesses and secrecies of consciousness where the world can seem a mere trace, a shadow amid the perplexing echoes of language. Conversations in this book are also characteristically elliptical, the words deployed with a sense of absences and deletion of things said and unsaid. The Sisters is obviously a heuristic entry in the book with its brooding on half-comprehended, half-stated conversations, its identification of the word gnomon, in one of its meanings a parallelogram with a part missing, as somehow textually significant. Taking that tale at its word, we are ready for the unsung stanza in Clay, the absent hero who is present between the lines throughout Ivy Day in the committee room, the absent lover in The Dead, and we are ready too for the misinterpretations, the vulgar errors, the confusions of so much of the talk in this book, where even the political activists of Ivy Day cannot, it seems, remember in 1902 that Queen Victoria had visited Dublin as recently as 1900. To read Dubliners as a moment in the history of the short story in English is therefore to become aware of the experimental nature of the work, of how its effects break the canons of classical realism for all the sense of context the writing also manages. These fragmentary sketches and impressions, arranged in complex pattern with detailed symbolist purport, these almost plotless stories together compose a text where consciousness seems a disjunct, isolated thing. No protagonist knows any other socially, even in the narrow world of the small city Joyce takes as subject, a clear infringement of realistic probabilities. Its moral motions, limited by the available linguistic resources, its spiritual condition more available to scrutiny over a few hours of trivial event than over a lifetime of significant action. Which is, of course, to say that Dubliners is also a chapter in the history of modernism, its textual strategies already anticipating the linguistic, stylistic, temporal and structural achievements of Ulysses, which itself had a source in a projected tale for the volume in hand. Dubliners is more, however, than just a particularly intriguing contribution to the modernist movement and a stage in the development of the modern short story in English. It is a work that, for all the fragmentary oblique quality of its procedures, its slight air of self-congratulatory hermeticism amid the sepia tints of an early photographic realism, its occasional purple patch, compels attention by the power of its unique vision of the world, its controlling sense of the truths of human experience as its author discerned them in a defeated colonial city. Those truths provoked anger, an almost vindictive rejection of the Ireland that would or could not transcend them, the satiric shudder of recoil from the terrible and cruel squalor of so much that takes place in these tales. Marital abuse, violence against a child, sexual exploitation and entrapment, casual political corruption, religious hypocrisy. But they do not, I believe, involve Joyce as artist in a rejection of the people in his stories. My poor fledglings, poor Corley, poor Ignatius Gallagher, he calls them with proprietorial affection as he compares them to characters in Thomas Hardy's short stories, who have no choice, it seems, but to endure the diminished lives they live. The emotional consequence of this kind of engagement with his material is, as Marilyn French has recently pointed out, a peculiarly Joycean synthesis of irony with compassion. The subject matter is the object of a satirist's ironic diagnostic skill. The effective contents engage his humanistic sympathies, almost despite himself, in an ambiguity of response that is as artistically complex as it is emotionally profound. And this is as true of a story like A Little Cloud or Clay as it is of the extraordinarily developed ironies, ambiguities, and final incertitudes in The Dead, with which the book concludes. There is too, even in so grim a set of stories as these are, the comedic impulse at work, lightening the mood of Grace, whatever the central irony, where we eavesdrop on a marvellously preposterous conversation around Mr. Kernan's sickbed. It is as if, for a moment in the text, Joyce reveals the bonding agent, comedy, which allows him to bring irony and compassion together, to show himself as the comic artist in the making who would eventually give the world Ulysses, in which some of Dubliner's Dubliners, some of those gathered about Mr. Kernan's bed indeed, would achieve comedic fictional apotheosis and occupy a text where variegated perspectives and a mythic method would bring to full term the embryonic modernism of this precociously experimental and achieved book. Terence Brown, Trinity College, Dublin.
The Sisters. There was no hope for him this time. It was the third stroke. Night after night I had passed the house, it was vacation time, and studied the lighted square of window, and night after night I had found it lighted in the same way, faintly and evenly. If he was dead, I thought, I would see the reflection of candles on the darkened blind, for I knew that two candles must be set at the head of a corpse. He had often said to me, "I am not long for this world," and I had thought his words idle. Now I knew they were true. Every night as I gazed up at the window, I said softly to myself the word, "paralysis." It had always sounded strangely in my ears, like the word "gnomon" in the Euclid, and the word "simony" in the Catechism. But now it sounded to me like the name of some maleficent and sinful being. It filled me with fear, and yet I longed to be nearer to it and to look upon its deadly work. Old Cotter was sitting at the fire, smoking, when I came downstairs to supper. While my aunt was ladling out my stirabout, he said, as if returning to some former remark of his, "No, I wouldn't say he was exactly... but there was something queer, there was something uncanny about him. I'll tell you my opinion." He began to puff at his pipe, no doubt arranging his opinion in his mind. Tiresome old fool. When we knew him first, he used to be rather interesting, talking of faints and worms, but I soon grew tired of him and his endless stories about the distillery. "I have my own theory about it," he said. "I think it was one of those peculiar cases, but it's hard to say." He began to puff again at his pipe without giving us his theory. My uncle saw me staring and said to me, "Well, so your old friend is gone, you'll be sorry to hear." "Who?" said I. "Father Flynn." "Is he dead?" "Mr. Cotter here has just told us. He was passing by the house." I knew that I was under observation, so I continued eating as if the news had not interested me. My uncle explained to old Cotter, "The youngster and he were great friends. The old chap taught him a great deal, mind you, and they say he had a great wish for him." "God have mercy on his soul," said my aunt piously. Old Cotter looked at me for a while. I felt that his little beady black eyes were examining me, but I would not satisfy him by looking up from my plate. He returned to his pipe and finally spat rudely into the grate. "I wouldn't like children of mine," he said, "to have too much to say to a man like that." "How do you mean, Mr. Cotter?" asked my aunt. "What I mean is," said old Cotter, "it's bad for children. My idea is... let a young lad run about and play with young lads of his own age and not be... am I right, Jack?" "That's my principle, too," said my uncle.
Let him learn to box his corner. That's what I'm always saying to that Rosicrucian there. Take exercise. Why, when I was a nipper every morning of my life, I had a cold bath, winter and summer. And that's what stands to me now. Education is all very fine and large. Mr. Cotter might take a pick of that leg of mutton, he added to my aunt. No, not for me, said old Cotter. My aunt brought the dish from the safe and laid it on the table. But why do you think it's not good for children, Mr. Cotter? She asked. It's bad for children, said old Cotter, because their minds are so impressionable. When children see things like that, you know, it has an effect. I crammed my mouth with stirabout for fear I might give utterance to my anger. Tiresome old red-nosed imbecile. It was late when I fell asleep. Though I was angry with old Cotter for alluding to me as a child, I puzzled my head to extract meaning from his unfinished sentences. In the dark of my room, I imagined that I saw again the heavy grey face of the paralytic. I drew the blankets over my head and tried to think of Christmas. But the grey face still followed me. It murmured, and I understood that it desired to confess something. I felt my soul receding into some pleasant and vicious region, and there again I found it waiting for me. It began to confess to me in a murmuring voice, and I wondered why it smiled continually and why the lips were so moist with spittle. But then I remembered that it had died of paralysis, and I felt that I too was smiling feebly, as if to absolve the simoniac of his sin. The next morning after breakfast, I went down to look at the little house in Great Britain Street. It was an unassuming shop, registered under the vague name of Drapery. The drapery consisted mainly of children's booties and umbrellas, and on ordinary days a notice used to hang in the window saying, "Umbrellas recovered." No notice was visible now, for the shutters were up. A crepe bouquet was tied to the door knocker with ribbon. Two poor women and a telegram boy were reading the card pinned on the crepe. I also approached and read, July 1st, 1895, the Reverend James Flynn, formerly of St. Catherine's Church, Meath Street, aged 65 years, or I.P. The reading of the card persuaded me that he was dead, and I was disturbed to find myself at check. Had he not been dead, I would have gone into the little dark room behind the shop to find him sitting in his armchair by the fire, nearly smothered in his greatcoat. Perhaps my aunt would have given me a packet of high toast for him, and this present would have roused him from his stupefied doze. It was always I who emptied the packet into his black snuff-box, for his hands trembled too much to allow him to do this without spilling half the snuff about the floor. Even as he raised his large trembling hand to his nose, little clouds of smoke dribbled through his fingers over the front of his coat. It may have been these constant showers of snuff which gave his ancient priestly garments their green faded look, for the red handkerchief, blackened as it always was, with the snuff stains of a week with which he tried to brush away the fallen grains, was quite inefficacious. I wished to go in and look at him, but I had not the courage to knock. I walked away slowly along the sunny side of the street, reading all the theatrical advertisements in the shop windows as I went. I found it strange that neither I nor the day seemed in a mourning mood, and I felt even annoyed at discovering in myself a sensation of freedom, as if I had been freed from something by his death. I wondered at this, for, as my uncle had said the night before, he had taught me a great deal. He had studied in the Irish College in Rome, and he had taught me to pronounce Latin properly. He had taught me stories about the catacombs, and about Napoleon Bonaparte, and he had explained to me the meaning of the different ceremonies of the Mass, and of the different vestments worn by the priest. Sometimes he had amused himself by putting difficult questions to me, asking me what one should do in certain circumstances, or whether such and such sins were mortal or venial or only imperfections. His questions showed me how complex and mysterious were certain institutions of the church, which I had always regarded as the simplest acts. The duties of the priest towards the Eucharist and towards the secrecy of the confessional seemed so grave to me that I wondered how anybody had ever found in himself the courage to undertake them. And I was not surprised when he told me that the fathers of the church had written books as thick as the post office directory, and as closely printed as the law notices in the newspaper, elucidating all these intricate questions. Often when I thought of this, I could make no answer, or only a very foolish and halting one, upon which he used to smile and nod his head twice or thrice. Sometimes he used to put me through the responses of the Mass, which he had made me learn by heart, and as I pattered, he used to smile pensively and nod his head, now and then pushing huge pinches of snuff up each nostril alternately. When he smiled, he used to uncover his big, discoloured teeth and let his tongue lie upon his lower lip, a habit which had made me feel uneasy in the beginning of our acquaintance, before I knew him well. As I walked along in the sun, I remembered old Cotter's words and tried to remember what had happened afterwards in the dream. I remembered that I had noticed long velvet curtains and a swinging lamp of antique fashion. I felt that I had been very far away in some land where the customs were strange. In Persia, I thought. But I could not remember the end of the dream. In the evening, my aunt took me with her to visit the house of mourning. It was after sunset, but the window panes of the houses that looked to the west reflected the tawny gold of a great bank of clouds. Nanny received us in the hall, and as it would have been unseemly to have shouted at her, my aunt shook hands with her for all. The old woman pointed upwards interrogatively, and on my aunt's nodding, proceeded to toil up the narrow staircase before us, her bowed head being scarcely above the level of the banister rail. At the first landing she stopped and beckoned us forward, encouragingly, towards the open door of the dead room. My aunt went in, and the old woman, seeing that I hesitated to enter, began to beckon to me again repeatedly with her hand. I went in on tiptoe. The room through the lace end of the blind was suffused with dusky golden light, amid which the candles looked like pale, thin flames. He had been coffined. Nanny gave the lead, and we three knelt down at the foot of the bed. I pretended to pray, but I could not gather my thoughts, because the old woman's mutterings distracted me. I noticed how clumsily her skirt was hooked to the back, and how the heels of her cloth boots were trodden down all to one side. The fancy came to me that the old priest was smiling as he lay there in his coffin. But no, when we rose and went up to the head of the bed, I saw that he was not smiling. There he lay, solemn and copious, vested as for the altar, his large hands loosely retaining a chalice. His face was very truculent, grey and massive, with black cavernous nostrils and circled by a scanty white fur. There was a heavy odour in the room, the flowers. We blessed ourselves and came away. In the little room downstairs we found Eliza seated in his armchair in state. I groped my way towards my usual chair in the corner, while Nanny went to the sideboard and brought out a decanter of sherry and some wine glasses. She set these on the table and invited us to take a little glass of wine. Then, at her sister's bidding, she poured out the sherry into the glasses and passed them to us. She pressed me to take some cream crackers also, but I declined because I thought I would make too much noise eating them. She seemed to be somewhat disappointed at my refusal and went over quietly to the sofa where she sat down behind her sister. No one spoke. We all gazed at the empty fireplace. My aunt waited until Eliza sighed and then said, "Ah, well, he's gone to a better world." Eliza sighed again and bowed her head in assent. My aunt fingered the stem of her wine glass before sipping a little.
Did he... peacefully?
She asked.
Oh, quite peacefully, ma'am, said Eliza. You couldn't tell when the breath went out of him. He had a beautiful death, God be praised. And everything...
Father O'Rourke was in with him at Tuesday and anointed him and prepared him and all.
He knew then. He was quite resigned. He looks quite resigned, said my aunt. That's what the woman we had in to wash him said. She said he just looked as if he was asleep. He looked that peaceful and resigned. No one would think he'd make such a beautiful corpse. Yes, indeed, said my aunt.
She sipped a little more from her glass and said,
Well, Miss Flynn, at any rate, it must be a great comfort for you to know that you did all you could for him. You were both very kind to him, I must say.
Eliza smoothed her dress over her knees.
Ah, poor James, she said. God knows we done all we could, as poor as we are. We wouldn't see him want anything while he was in it.
Nanny had leaned her head against the sofa pillow and seemed about to fall asleep.
There's poor Nanny, said Eliza, looking at her. She's wore out. All the work we had, she and me, getting in the woman to wash him, and then laying him out, and then the coffin, and then arranging about the mass and the chapel. Only for Father O'Rourke, I don't know what we'd have done at all. It was him brought us all them flowers and them two candlesticks out of the chapel, and wrote out the notice for the Freeman's General, and took charge of all the papers for the cemetery and poor James's insurance. Wasn't that good of him? Said my aunt.
Eliza closed her eyes and shook her head slowly.
Ah, there's no friends like the old friends, she said. When all is said and done, no friends that a body can trust. Indeed, that's true, said my aunt. And I'm sure now that he's gone to his eternal reward, he won't forget you and all your kindness to him. Ah, poor James, said Eliza. He was no great trouble to us. You wouldn't hear him in the house any more than now. Still, I know he's gone and all to that. It's when it's all over that you'll miss him, said my aunt.
I know that, said Eliza.
I won't be bringing him in his cup of beef tea any more. Nor you, ma'am, sending him his snuff. Ah, poor James.
She stopped as if she were communing with the past and then said shrewdly,
Mind you, I noticed there was something queer coming over him latterly. Whenever I'd bring in his soup to him, there I'd find him with his breviary fallen to the floor, lying back in the chair and his mouth open.
She laid a finger against her nose and frowned. Then she continued,
But still and all, he kept on saying that before the summer was over, he'd go out for a drive one fine day just to see the old house again, where we were all born down in Irish Town, and take me and Nanny with him. If you could only get one of them newfangled carriages that makes no noise that Father O'Rourke told him about, them with the rheumatic wheels, for the day cheap, he said, at Johnny Rush's over the way there, and drive out the three of us together of a Sunday evening. He had his mind set on that. Poor James.
The Lord have mercy on his soul, said my aunt. Eliza took out her handkerchief and wiped her eyes with it. Then she put it back again in her pocket and gazed into the empty grate for some time without speaking.
He was too scrupulous always, she said. The duties of the priesthood was too much for him, and then his life was, you might say, crossed.
Yes, said my aunt.
He was a disappointed man. You could see that.
A silence took possession of the little room, and under cover of it, I approached the table and tasted my sherry, and then returned quietly to my chair in the corner. Eliza seemed to have fallen into a deep reverie. We waited respectfully for her to break the silence, and after a long pause she said slowly,
It was that chalice he broke. That was the beginning of it. Of course they said it was all right, that it contained nothing. I mean, but still. They say it was the boy's fault. But poor James was so nervous, God be merciful to him. And was that it? Said my aunt. I heard something. Eliza nodded. That affected his mind, she said. After that, he began to mope by himself, talking to no one, and wandering about by himself. So one night he was wanted for to go on a call, and they couldn't find him anywhere. They looked high up and low down, and still they couldn't see a sight of him anywhere. So then the clerk suggested to try the chapel, so then they got the keys and opened the chapel, and the clerk and Father O'Rourke and another priest that was there brought in a light for to look from. And what do you think? But there he was, sitting up by himself in the dark in his confession box, wide awake, and laughing, like, softly to himself. She stopped suddenly, as if to listen. I too listened, but there was no sound in the house, and I knew that the old priest was lying still in his coffin, as we had seen him, solemn and truculent in death, an idle chalice on his breast. Eliza resumed, wide awake and laughing, like to himself. So then, of course, when they saw that, that made them think that there was something gone wrong with him.
An encounter. It was Joe Dillon who introduced the Wild West to us. He had a little library made up of old numbers of the Union Jack, Pluck, and the Halfpenny Marvel. Every evening after school we met in his back garden and arranged Indian battles. He and his fat young brother Leo the Idler held the loft of the stable while we tried to carry it by storm, or we fought a pitched battle on the grass. But however well we fought, we never won siege or battle, and all our bouts ended with Joe Dillon's war dance of victory. His parents went to 8 o'clock mass every morning in Gardiner Street, and the peaceful odour of Mrs. Dillon was prevalent in the hall of the house. But he played too fiercely for us, who were younger and more timid. He looked like some kind of an Indian when he capered around the garden, an old tea cosy on his head, beating a tin with his fist and yelling, "Yah! Yaka, yaka, yaka!" Everyone was incredulous when it was reported that he had a vocation for the priesthood. Nevertheless, it was true. A spirit of unruliness diffused itself among us, and under its influence differences of culture and constitution were waived. We banded ourselves together, some boldly, some in jest, and some almost in fear. And of the number of these latter, the reluctant Indians who were afraid to seem studious or lacking in robustness, I was one. The adventures related in the literature of the Wild West were remote from my nature, but at least they opened doors of escape. I liked better some American detective stories which were traversed from time to time by unkempt, fierce and beautiful girls. Though there was nothing wrong in these stories, and though their intention was sometimes literary, they were circulated secretly at school. One day when Father Butler was hearing the 4 pages of Roman history, clumsy Leo Dillon was discovered with a copy of the Halfpenny Marvel. "This page or this page? This page? Now, Dillon, up. Hardly had the day... Go on. What day? Hardly had the day dawned. Have you studied it? What have you there in your pocket?" Everyone's heart palpitated as Leo Dillon handed up the paper, and everyone assumed an innocent face. Father Butler turned over the pages, frowning. "What is this rubbish?" he said. "The Apache chief? Is this what you read instead of studying a Roman history? Let me not find any more of this wretched stuff in this college. The man who wrote it, I suppose, was some wretched scribbler that writes these things for a drink. I'm surprised at boys like you, educated, reading such stuff. I could understand it if you were...
National School boys. Now, Dylan, I advise you strongly, get at your work, or...
This rebuke during the sober hours of school paled much of the glory of the Wild West for me in the confused, puffy face of Leo Dylan, awakened one of my consciences. But when the restraining influence of the school was at a distance, I began to hunger again for wild sensations, for the escape which those chronicles of disorder alone seemed to offer me. The mimic warfare of the evening became at last as wearisome to me as the routine of school in the morning, because I wanted real adventures to happen to myself. But real adventures, I reflected, do not happen to people who remain at home. They must be sought abroad. The summer holidays were near at hand when I made up my mind to break out of the weariness of school life for one day, at least. With Leo Dylan and a boy named Mahoney, I planned a day's mitching. Each of us saved up sixpence. We were to meet at 10 in the morning on the canal bridge. Mahoney's big sister was to write an excuse for him, and Leo Dylan was to tell his brother to say he was sick. We arranged to go along the wharf road until we came to the ships, then to cross in the ferry boat and walk out to see the pigeon house. Leo Dylan was afraid we might meet Father Butler, or someone out of the college, but Mahoney asked very sensibly, what would Father Butler be doing out at the pigeon house? We were reassured, and I brought the first stage of the plot to an end by collecting sixpence from the other two, at the same time showing them my own sixpence. When we were making the last arrangements on the eve, we were all vaguely excited. We shook hands, laughing, and Mahoney said, "Till tomorrow, mates." That night, I slept badly. In the morning, I was first comer to the bridge, as I lived nearest. I hid my books in the long grass near the ash pit at the end of the garden, where nobody ever came, and hurried along the canal bank. It was a mild, sunny morning in the first week of June. I sat up on the coping of the bridge, admiring my frail canvas shoes, which I had diligently pipe-clayed overnight, and watching the docile horses pulling a tramload of business people up the hill. All the branches of the tall trees which lined the mall were gay with little light green leaves, and the sunlight slanted through them onto the water. The granite stone of the bridge was beginning to be warm, and I began to pat it with my hands in time to an air in my head. I was very happy. When I'd been sitting there for 5 or 10 minutes, I saw Mahoney's grey suit approaching. He came up the hill smiling and clambered up beside me on the bridge. While we were waiting, he brought out the catapult, which bulged from his inner pocket, and explained some improvements which he had made in it. I asked him why he had brought it, and he told me he had brought it to have some gas with the birds. Mahoney used slang freely, and spoke of Father Butler as Bunsen Burner. We waited on for a quarter of an hour more, but still there was no sign of Leo Dylan. Mahoney at last jumped down and said, "Come along, I knew Fatty'd funk it." "And his sixpence?" I said. "That's forfeit," said Mahoney. "And so much the better for us, a bob and a tanner instead of a bob." We walked along the North Strand Road till we came to the vitriol works, and then turned to the right along the wharf road. Mahoney began to play the Indian as soon as we were out of public sight. He chased a crowd of ragged girls, brandishing his unloaded catapult, and when two ragged boys began out of chivalry to fling stones at us, he proposed that we should charge them. I objected that the boys were too small, and so we walked on, the ragged troops screaming after us, "Swaddlers! Swaddlers!" thinking that we were Protestants, because Mahoney, who was dark-complexioned, wore the silver badge of a cricket club in his cap. When we came to the smoothing iron, we arranged a siege, but it was a failure because he must have at least three. We revenged ourselves on Leo Dylan by saying what a funk he was and guessing how many he would get at 3 o'clock from Mr. Ryan. We came then near the river. We spent a long time walking about the noisy streets flanked by high stone walls, watching the working of cranes and engines and often being shouted at for our immobility by the drivers of groaning carts. It was noon when we reached the quays, and as all the labourers seemed to be eating their lunches, we bought 2 big currant buns and sat down to eat them on some metal piping beside the river. We pleased ourselves with the spectacle of Dublin's commerce, the barges signalled from far away by their curls of woolly smoke, the brown fishing fleet beyond Ringsend, the big white sailing vessel which was being discharged on the opposite quay. Mahony said it would be right skit to run away to sea in one of those big ships, and even I, looking at the high masts, saw, or imagined, the geography which had been scantily dosed to me at school, gradually taking substance under my eyes. School and home seemed to recede from us, and their influences upon us seemed to wane. We crossed the Liffey in the ferry-boat, paying our toll to be transported in the company of 2 labourers and a little Jew with a bag. We were serious to the point of solemnity, but once during the short voyage our eyes met and we laughed. When we landed, we watched the discharging of the graceful three-master, which we had observed from the other quay. Some bystander said that she was a Norwegian vessel. I went to the stern and tried to decipher the legend upon it, but failing to do so, I came back and examined the foreign sailors to see had any of them green eyes, for I had some confused notion. The sailors' eyes were blue and grey and even black. The only sailor whose eyes could have been called green was a tall man who amused the crowd on the quay by calling out cheerfully every time the planks fell. All right! All right! When we were tired of this sight, we wandered slowly into Ringsend. The day had grown sultry, and in the windows of the grocer's shops, musty biscuits lay bleaching. We bought some biscuits and chocolate, which we ate sedulously as we wandered through the squalid streets, where the families of the fishermen live. We could find no dairy, so we went into a huckster's shop and bought a bottle of raspberry lemonade each. Refreshed by this, Mahony chased a cat down a lane, but the cat escaped into a wide field. We both felt rather tired, and when we reached the field, we made at once for a sloping bank over the ridge of which we could see the Dodder.